My name is Lamar Clark, lead analyst covering payments and fintech here at Freedom Capital Markets. And today I have the pleasure of hosting Evangelos Perros, CFO of Pagaya, for a fireside chat. EP, thanks for taking the time and agreeing to do this. Definitely looking forward to our upcoming discussion here.
Thank you for having me, and thanks everyone for joining us today. Appreciate all the focus and effort and desire to learn more about Pagaya.
Perfect. So just a bit of housekeeping before we start. I'll probably go for about the first 20 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for an opportunity for investors to ask questions. If you want to ask a question, please raise your hands or you can submit them in the chat. So let's just jump right into it, EP. Maybe a good starting point, since we have you, is to give a brief introduction about Pagaya and where you guys sit in the broader financial ecosystem.
Sure, happy to. So for people who don't know Pagaya, think about us as an AI-enabled technology company and network that brings together lending partners on one side, like financial institutions that we integrate our technology into, companies like banks and non-banks, US Bank, Ally, SoFi, LendingClub, Klarna on the POS. So we integrate our technology and basically do underwriting on their behalf, and then connecting those assets that our technology generates directly into investment vehicles on the other side. And we work with 155 unique investors along different types of funding vehicles, ABS, forward flows, pass-through structures. And today we have one of the strongest sort of network of funding or investment partners, and access to the deepest pocket of institutional capital. And through that network and that technology, we obviously make money by generating fees from both sides of the network. 80% of the fees come from the lending partner side for the use of our technology. And then the other 20% comes from the investing side of the house. So think of us as a B2B to C type of business. We don't go directly to the consumer. We have no customer acquisition cost or marketing cost. So we play quite uniquely in that space, and continue to expand effectively the application flow of our lending partners through the use of our technology.
Okay, no, that's helpful color. I guess maybe talk about the broader competitive landscape. Who are your competitors in the space that you operate in? What sets you apart, drives your competitive moat? And I guess to that end, within this B2B to C network that you have, talk about your own production data capabilities and any potential differentiation amongst peers that you may have from an underwriting standpoint, or even an ability to deliver strong credit outcomes for your funding partners.
Yeah, so that's obviously an interesting question, and we get that a lot. So if we actually think about it, there's no other real competitor at the scale, at least that we have in the space. If you think about fintechs in general, and you go back a few years ago, decades ago, the proliferation of fintechs came as a result of a lot of the regulatory constraints that was put on the banks, generally the banking environment. But a lot of those fintechs, all of them basically chose to create a platform that goes directly to the consumer and create brands, which is, it's a different business. It's a great business model, but it's a different business model. If you look at our history and how we started, effectively, we're all solving for the same problem. I try to get more credit to more people who were otherwise denied credit as a result of the changes in the banking environment. But we set the business in actually to go out and solve the problem, or the issue where it exactly was, which is within the banking system. This is the type of business that banks used to be back in the day, and they retreated away from that again because of the either capital requirements or other sort of, as they think about their capital allocation. Now we can go take our technology and still sort of provide and expand credit to those banks, which they otherwise are not willing to take. And remember, the value proposition for us is that we make the partnership with the lending partners. They make fees out of that. They are the originator on record, so they continue to make servicing through the life of the loan. But more importantly, it works as a trap for the lending partners, or in the case of auto originators, for the dealers, or in the case of BNPL providers, for the merchants. So we're quite unique in that, in terms of the scale that we have built, the technology. We adhere to the same regulatory requirements effectively on their behalf. We are not regulated, but we have to adhere to their standards. So when you actually look at the space, nobody else has built out this type of infrastructure and the ability to connect both sides of the network to the level that we have. There are other potentially players that may have been used to basically use models, but more as a validation point or as a software. But we're something completely different than that, and there is no other player in the space. And I think, to your point now, where the benefit comes is, through the integration with those lending partners, the data advances is quite unique. We look at data from 30 plus different partners across multiple channels, three asset classes: personal loans, auto, and point of sale. We get about $1 trillion of application flow from our partners a year when you look at Q4 annualized. We extend about 10% of offers back to those partners, and we convert 10% of that, to call it, to get to that $10+ billion of volume. And that production data is quite unique. The partners have their own production data from their own funnels, but they don't see that across the multiple partners. And we see everything from big banks all the way to fintechs across multiple asset classes. So that's where the data moat really stands, and that's what really differentiates our underwriting.
No, makes sense. Sounds like a very strong competitive moat, and it's probably a good segue into my next question as it relates to the integration across those 30 different lending partners that you have, and the lens that it gives you from a credit underwriting standpoint. So I guess in your most recent earnings results, you announced your decision more so in December to pull back on credit to riskier credit segments to the tune of 100 to 150 million, and an expectation to maintain that posture throughout the course of this year. Maybe just unpack the different considerations there around what you're seeing that led to that decision.
Yeah, and let me take a little bit of extra time on that, because obviously I'll try to take you back to when we make that decision and what we communicated so we can provide more clarity, but also how things may have changed since then, given everything that's happening in the world. So I think we have that unique advantage point of being able to react, first of all, very quickly. We are a B2B. We don't have all these different customer acquisition costs or campaigns. So the ability to turn the switch and make changes to our underwriting, it's very easily implemented. So if I take you back now to, call it, end of 2025, December, we're now sitting in an environment back then of macro uncertainty that has been protracted for a while. It's not the ones that we saw during Liberation Day, where things lasted for 2 or 3 weeks. Uncertainty around, obviously, geopolitics, even though back then it was mostly Latin America. You have uncertainty around the K economy, the upper end of the K, the lower part of the K. You have unemployment risk, the uncertainty about path of interest rates. And that's one piece, sort of the input that we got, which is always an overlay that we look into. The other part is it's the signaling that we get from the partners. And I think there was maybe some confusion that we might have created, but effectively what we saw is partners who have been growing by, call it, 50% or so, let's call it, in 2025 versus 2024 in a very frothy market. Now thinking about their growth in 2026 relative to 2025 of something less than that. Not that they're tightening credit or that they're cutting, but more so being a little bit more balanced in terms of their growth expectations. And even though now, when you take that into consideration, you think about the operating leverage, still in an environment where you have a very healthy and sort of resilient consumer and credit performance is still well within expectations, Where we sit is now saying, okay, why take that risk when you have a business that can still deliver $100 to $150 million of GAAP net income profitability, 50% growth year over year, approximately, and having very, very good visibility on new partners coming on boarded, 8 of them at that time, still 8, 4 we have already onboarded and started production with. Saying we have very good visibility, we can replace that higher cost, the higher risk production with more balanced risk and still continue to grow. It seems like a very easy decision not to lean into that uncertainty. And that's what we decided to do. And I think most importantly, you know, the cut itself in 4Q was 100, call it 150 million, not as material for a quarter. But we carried that decision forward for the entire 2026 and still delivering, call it 15% or so growth year over year at the midpoint of our guidance on the volume side. So that's how to think a little bit about where we stand and why we took the decision. It's quite unique in our ability to do so because of what we have, the operating leverage, the ability to react quickly, still deliver profitability, and very good visibility of where the new volume is going to come in because we're already having 8 partners on the onboarding phase. So hopefully that
Okay.
gives you a little bit of a sense. Since then, obviously, you know, the macro environment, you know, it's obviously in a different place. The geopolitical risk is much more elevated. I don't have to explain that. I think as a result of this, now you have much more of the inflation risk on top of a little bit the unemployment risk that you had there. So, and while, by the way, some of these risks or uncertainties have not yet materialized, it's still very early to tell. Obviously, the uncertainty and the volatility is elevated. And I would say all of this keeps us in a much, you know, continue to be on a disciplined sort of posture. And continue to optimize and really be balanced across profitability, liquidity, and growth. And I would say certain parts of the, call it, certain areas of business, of the business obviously will have much more variability, but there are others as well where we're actually executing, you know, ahead of sort of expectation. And a good example is that we have now onboarded four new partners. Now, the consumer is still healthy and you know, resilient, okay, but it's something that everybody obviously is monitoring much more more closely, and day by day trying to get a better understanding where things are shaking out.
Makes sense. And you mentioned that the commentary provided around the credit tightening created a bit of confusion, given the fact that you're tightening, and then you know some of your lending partners are not specifically messaging a conservative posture publicly to investors. So maybe unpack to the extent that you can the uniqueness of the B2B relationship that you have, that may inherently result in a disconnect at times between what you're able to see versus what other investors may be hearing from various lenders, which may be more so through a B2C lens.
I think the key thing here is that on top of obviously the data and AI-enabled sort of underwriting that we still have a significant risk overlay sort of decision-making process on top of that. And effectively, when you think about where we're standing in December, when you see across multiple different partners a little bit more of that balanced growth trajectory 1 year forward versus where we were before, that's a signal that you don't necessarily dismiss. Now, whether you take action or not, it's a little bit different based on the business model. So again, think about the B2C as an example. You know, they have customer acquisition cost. The engine is currently running, pulling forward or pulling back and resetting if the situation doesn't really transpire into this uncertainty transpire into a risk. It's a little bit different of a decision that they have to take and sort of adjust their operations. For us, it's much easier. We don't have any of that. It's genuinely a lever in terms of how we underwrite. And by the way, what we did is, just to be clear, we cut the riskiest part of the production, still profitable because we're pricing obviously for that risk, but that's the one that has potentially a more adverse outcome should that uncertainty become a real risk. And 1 or 2 years out. And that's quite unique into a B2B business model because you don't have this change that you need to do in your sort of the way you reach out to consumers and things like that. And by the way, as I said, the signal gives you high enough confidence to not to dismiss it, but the action again is relying on the fact that we have the operating leverage and more so the visibility on the new partners that are coming on board soon thereafter.
Makes sense. You mentioned the recent market developments. Two main ones: the potential fallout in private credit markets, and then you have the rise in geopolitical tension. So, I guess on the funding side, maybe just talk about what you're seeing in terms of the recent appetite from your funding market partners, any potential pricing spread implications that you're seeing in recent deals, that you've done, and then just any general thoughts on the durability of the channel.
I think it may be useful to step back a little bit and give you the full picture in very quickly, like in 2025 and how where we are today. So if I actually take you back in, call it first half or first 3 quarters of 2025, you had a very frothy market, right? Everybody's deploying a lot of large amounts of capital into private credit across the different asset classes, whether consumer credit or corporate credit. And then at some point, call it later part of 2025, there is a little bit more of a momentum break. And now a lot of these private credit providers are a little bit more disciplined in which platforms they work with. They're looking for more scaled platforms, more diversified sort of exposure. And obviously we're benefiting from that because we can deliver that to them, but also because of the cuts that we did, it actually improves overall, all else being equal, the credit profile of the loans that we provide to them. And therefore we manage to continue to see strong demand for our production. And you can see that validated by, the new forward flow that we did in auto late Q4, new forward flow in point of sale, increased upsized and oversubscribed deals in January at lower spreads or lower cost of debt overall. New revolving transaction with 26 North, sale of a certificate earlier. So a lot of things that are, giving us a lot of high confidence that we're delivering for our investors and validated by their demand. Now, again, we're a network. So even though you're having disproportionately more demand, I cannot really feed it because, again, on the other side of the network, we cut that riskier part of the production. But it's a good imbalance to have. 1 month forward or so, call it, or where we are today, I think there is this concern on the private credit side, and we see that in the headlines. What I would say is a couple of things. One is there is still, it's primarily focused on the corporate side as a result of the AI sort of narrative. And there's a real risk, like a real issue there, as we can see. There is the banks that are pulling a lot of the back leverage and things like that. So it's you see those uncertainties and risk happening there. We haven't seen a change in the consumer side of the credit. Think about it because those are different sort of strategies. I would say that in credit, there is obviously the contentious risk, right, of things moving from one sort of strategy to another. At the same time, we may benefit a little bit to the extent it hits the originators first, and then we actually see a little bit more demand for our solution for them. So, but all of that is being sort of, worked out every day. But there is obviously a real risk. And to your point, look, we were 2 weeks ago in the market with an ABS deal in auto, and we saw very little change in the cost, maybe a little bit of white of spreads widening on the, call it, lower stack by, call it, 30 or so basis points, which is for a platform of our scale and size, it's nothing to be concerned about. And actually, we saw some tightening on the upper end. Now, again, it was only 2 weeks into the whole situation, right, with everything happening. It's something that we're cautious and constantly looking and monitoring because we just need to see how these things unfold. But so far, they continue to see the demand, and we feel obviously good about the fact that we took some of that already sort of buffer, let's call it, in December, right?
And then I guess to your point, from where we sit today relative to when you reported, the geopolitical climate has changed. There's obviously higher inflation risk on the back of that, which may likely place some stress on the consumer if this persists on a sustained basis. So maybe provide some color on how you're weighing, that, recent market development, especially considering the reason for your pullback starting in Q4 was due to rising macro uncertainty.
So what I would say, it's obviously something we're very closely monitoring, and everybody is. The inflation risk is somewhat of a new risk relative in December, and it's a real risk. What I would say is obviously inflation tends to hit the type of consumer of the call it a, lower income. And if you look a little bit at our profile of the consumer that we're underwriting, it's, average income, call it on the personal loan, is $110,000, $115,000, which is somewhat more insulated from inflation risk. Now, again, we need to monitor and think, how long this inflation risk is going to last and whether it's going to be a reaction. But maybe the way to say it is like, if you think about the K economy, it's mostly impacting the lower part of the K. And we're not underwriting that type of consumer generally. I think people are actually surprised to hear that our average consumer has $115,000 of income, 680 or so FICO score, 17 years of credit history. So just to put that a little bit in perspective. Having said that, again, it depends on how long the situation lasts, whether there's going to be any reaction, any intervention, and things like that. So closely monitoring that. Because the uncertainty is still there, obviously.
Let's touch on your lending partners and the pipeline opportunity that's there, which you guys have mentioned is pretty robust right now. And when you reported, you mentioned near-term onboarding plans expected in Q1. So maybe just provide an update on that front, and then more broadly about the pipeline you have, general onboarding expectations for the rest of the year, and the level of visibility that you have there.
So, what, we finished the year with basically the best place we have ever been in our history in terms of the visibility into onboarding new lending partners. We had eight on that list, effectively eight coming out of the pipeline and going to the onboarding phase. Good mix across the asset classes and between banks and non-banks. We announced that we had three in the onboarding phase being onboarded at earnings, and another one that we onboarded a few weeks ago. And we still feel very good about the other sort of coming along over the course of the next few quarters. And that's obviously a very powerful place to be because it gives us very good visibility on sort of new partner ramp up, the type of volume that we expect, obviously with some variability and timing and things that, and that's what's right, basically driving a little bit the, by the way, the guidance that we have provided on the volume side, i.e., higher end of the volume implies that we're accelerating the onboarding of the new partners and the adoption of the new products by the existing partners ahead of, let's say, some expectations. And then on the lower end, sort of being a little bit more muted in terms of the adoption and a little bit more delayed. But we feel very good about that and the ability to continue to onboard new partners. Very excited about the new products as well. About 55% of the volume and fees that we do to 50% of the volume and fees that we do today is from the pure decline monetization program. A lot of the other comes from product like affiliates, pre-screen product, which is a very interesting product where we try to go and use the marketing engine of our lending partners to actually provide offers to consumers that they have in the consumer base and with a higher activation rate. We have the dual look, first look. All of these are giving us significant more access and expansion of the application flow with our partners. One interesting statistic that I like to share is that we have the existing partners only have about 60 million of consumers that they serve. And we have extended credit in our history to about 2 to 2.5 million of those consumers. Now, not all of them will be eligible for Pagaya, but that gives you a little bit of a sense of where we are in the penetration with the existing partners as well. On the pipeline itself, look, the great thing about our business is that, you know, you don't have to go out and acquire thousands of, and there aren't even that many players out there. You know, there is, call it, 30, 50, 60, maybe 100 more players in the space across all the different players and types. We have a very robust pipeline. We're in discussions with a lot of the names that you would think of. And we see it's particularly a lot of demand from the banks, particularly regionals or super regionals who want to, you know, restart the personal loan business. They want to go into the POS credit side. So a lot of demand there, but obviously it takes a lot of time to like, and it's a long incubation period from the initial discussion to put them in the onboarding phase, but feel very good about the pipeline.
Sounds good. So I have a bunch of remaining questions, but want to pause for a brief moment to maybe open it up to the floor. In the event that anyone has questions, again, please feel free to raise your hands or drop any questions you may have in the chat. I think Ryan, I don't see any questions. I'll keep going, but feel free to submit questions or email me directly if you prefer. Let's pivot to the funding side of the equation. I know you guys have diversified channels over the past few years, driving more of a balance between ABS and forward flow transactions. So just maybe talk about that evolving mix shift and the increase in diversification of your funding channels and any potential implications there.
Look, the diversification is a win-win strategy for a business that is otherwise relying on its technology to actually, you know, generate fees. So if we actually step back, we have been doing this for a while. We're diversifying in, you know, if you go back to when the business started and we start, you know, we were going through 100% ABS funding, we tried to diversify the number of partners we're working with. And initially, we're relying on a few partners. Today, we work with over 155 partners in the ABS side. Once we accomplish that, and obviously we continue to scale that, we started diversifying the funding away from ABS in order to create a better balance between sort of frictionless market execution, which you can achieve in the ABS, and sort of having a little bit more visibility from the funding side by introducing a lot of these forward flows that we did. And now the next sort of level is to continue to add more partners of smaller sizes. So diversify on that forward flow, and also very excited about some of the other products that we have done, which is the revolving ABS, which is effectively a structure, an ABS structure, but where you redeploy the capital. And, you know, we're very excited about that because, you know, we did three deals of those last year for a total of $1 billion across three deals. But it actually provides us up to $3 billion of capacity over the next 2 years in a very sort of well-expected and visible manner. The plan is to create a good balance between sort of access to frictionless access to capital, but also visibility. And the goal is to have that be sort of in a balanced way. So we're not sort of exposed to one or two sort of three or names or, you know, and being dependent on a few investors, but at the same time having the visibility and deal with a potential dislocation, let's say, at any point in time in the marketplace in ABS. And remember, in our ABS, we all do all of our pre-ABS is pre-funding ABS, which is exactly the point of having always visibility and access to funding and always having dry powder on the side, even if that comes at a slightly higher cost.
Fair. I guess let's shift a bit to the revenue model and your fee revenue less production cost take rate, and maybe just delve a bit into how investors should think about this metric given the ongoing change in dynamics in the business. You have a robust pipeline of new lending partners being onboarded, evolving mix in the funding channels, you have newer products that you're rolling out, and then you have a change in asset class mix with the POS product being the fastest growing segment. So maybe just help kind of like, I know that's a lot, but probably help just unpack, all of those ongoing shifts as it relates to the FRLPC take rate, which I know is your key metric.
So the way to think about it is, the drivers, let's say, of our unit economics, which are primarily driven or portrayed through the fee revenue less production cost, is driven by asset mix, asset class mix, i.e., personal loans, auto, and POS, partner mix, new partners versus mature partners, and to some extent, the funding mix. And then within the asset classes, when you think about take rates and revenues, take rates are generally higher on the personal loan side versus the POS. So when you think about the dynamics, what we have said is, in terms of FRLPC, we expect to range but between, let's call it 4 to 5%, and we have been delivering that. If I take you back in history, that was a very much of a focus from the senior leadership here to enhance this, to drive up these unit economics. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was less than 2.5, 3%. And last quarter, it was 4.9%. So we managed that to get that up. And again, more importantly, make it 8% be from the lending partner side, which is much more stable and sticky in nature. As you think about this going forward, I think now it's all about sort of continued volume growth and harnessing, sort of monetizing these relationships. And when you think about the dynamics and the fact that POS and auto are generally growing faster, POS being a few years behind the other asset classes and therefore at the lower, generally speaking, like lower fee rates, you should see some sort of headwinds on the actual fee rate. And you should expect to see, as we have pointed out in our last quarter, that sort of fee rate to come closer to the midpoint of that 4 to 5% range as early as call it in Q1. Now, again, the way to though think about it is you have this FRLPC rate, but when you think about fees and net, the net fees and the revenues, it's this times the volume. So as the volume continues to grow through the new partners and new products, you will basically continue to see growth in fee revenues. And given the operating leverage and the reasonably stable cost, a very high flow through from those fees coming straight to the bottom line. If you actually look at the P&L of Pagaya, purely just the P&L, it's a very much tech-like type of P&L. There is no customer acquisition cost, and you don't really see that elsewhere in the consumer lending space. So as we continue to grow fees in terms of in dollar terms, and you expect to, and we should expect to have this high flow through, that's how you drive sort of bottom line profitability.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably a great segue into my next question, which is, talking about the embedded operating leverage in the business as you continue to achieve a certain amount of scale. And, probably, just kind of like touching on some of the various drivers which led to the GAAP profitability inflection achieved last year, and then the expectation for, greater than 100 million of GAAP net income expected this year, which is a 50% increase year over year, despite you pulling back credit exposure to the riskier segments. I think it's a great part of the overall theme.
Obviously, very pleased with the progress that we have achieved here. Like, if I take you back in early 2024, we basically reset the financial strategy around two things, and two things only: getting to be GAAP net income profitable and cash flow positive. And we achieved that through three ways. One is improving unit economics, this FRLPC rate growing from 2 to 3% now to 4 to 5%. Two, operating leverage, and making sure that we maintain that. And people should know that we have the infrastructure is already built out to be able to do even double or triple the amount of volume, because there is no incremental customer acquisition cost in the business. Obviously, there's going to be some investment along the line, inflationary growth, but there is no incremental investment that's required into the business. And obviously, then the capital efficiency. And I think what we did last year is where we passed that inflection point. So you saw us deliver 80 or so, $81 million of GAAP net income profitability. And to my point earlier, on a marginal basis, the next, call it $100 of volume that comes through, I'd call it that 4 to 5% fees. There is very high flow through straight to the bottom line. And that obviously drives the gap in net income profitability, which again, that's quite unique in the consumer lending sort of fintech space, as you can obviously look around some of our peers.
Fair, makes sense. Maybe just touch on capital allocation priorities, considering the recent downward pressure on shares, maybe any potential for share buybacks. I know you have some senior notes yielding in the high teens currently. So just any thoughts that you might share on kind of like current thoughts on capital allocation?
Yeah. Well, first, to tie it to the previous question, when you think about any business, looking about capital allocation, the first thing is like sort of considering is growth CapEx. And we don't have that. We don't have to invest in the business. As I said previously, the infrastructure is already built out. Now, having said that, if you actually see us expand into different asset classes, we may consider, obviously, inorganic growth opportunities. And if our partners grow to other asset classes, we'll go with them. And that's something that we can consider. And we obviously have the capacity to do that again, because that would not be competing with call it organic growth CapEx, because we don't have that. To your point, though, as we think about capital allocation, what we have been saying is, you know, there is always the opportunity to, on the ABS side, to lower the cost of debt in our ABS by holding some of the more expensive tranches above the certificates. And not only it lowers the cost of debt, but it also provides access to potential liquidity if we need to, because these are coupon-paying type of securities that are easily leverageable or we can sell. But more importantly, over the cycle, it mitigates the risk of that, those tranches, which are primarily non-IG, to actually spike in cost. And our ability to hold them, which again, it's pretty much in line with what others are doing that have the capacity to actually sort of mitigate that type of risk. So those are generally the three areas, i.e., you know, now that we're generating excess cash, we can use into the ABS, no real growth CapEx, but keep sort of building the war chest for potential inorganic opportunities. To your point, recently, there is more dislocation, obviously, in the marketplace, both in terms of the bond and the high yield bond that we did last year, which was an incredible sort of accomplishment, as well as the stock, obviously, dislocation. Those are starting and have been now competing, let's say, like really good alternatives in terms of the capital allocation. And we have stepped in to some extent to do some of that, particularly on the high yield bond. And look, at the end of the day, we'll continue to reassess this day in, day out on how best to allocate the next dollar of excess cash that we're generating. Again, it's a place where you have also a lot of uncertainty, so you need to think about how to manage that. But we feel very good about sort of our cash position, the excess cash, and it's something definitely that we're looking day in, day out, and you know, more to come obviously on that as well.
Great. Just out of curiosity, and you mentioned potential asset class expansion. So I know the company was originally founded on personal loans. You've expanded to autos and then POS lending recently. Just any potential plans to expand beyond those three asset classes? And what are some of the asset classes you think could be a strong fit for Pagaya longer
Yeah.
term?
So strategically, the way you should think about us is like, think about us, call it a utility for our lending partners. So wherever our lending partners go, we would go with them. Our goal is to be integrated to every sort of financial institution in consumer credit out there. But having said that, we obviously have to have the capabilities of that technology and the underwriting and the data. So we did start the business with personal loans, expanded to auto and obviously POS. I think while there is no immediate plans, at least let's say at this juncture, and especially for 2026, you know, to sort of start thinking about opportunities like this, primarily because the ROI on the existing assets class is so high and we continue to execute it. But, you know, a couple of areas that could potentially be of interest is again within the consumer credit, but types of assets that have similar risk reward profile and similar duration that actually very tangential to some of the existing asset class from an underwriting perspective. So think about potentially, credit cards could be something that could potentially be interesting. Other sub asset classes in point of sale where you still have that, call it, certain level of duration, purpose driven type of consumer spend and credit. Those are a couple of the areas that we could put, and we actually see from our partners in our discussions on prospective partners who express some interest. So again, wherever our partners go, you should see us go as well.
Perfect. And then I had two questions come in from an investor. The first is the top three things, issues, challenges asked by larger shareholders. And then what do you believe is the biggest point of confusion in relation to what you're seeing versus how the buy side is perceiving the current outlook?
So can you repeat the first part? Just on the top three, what
Just
was
the
it?
top issues, challenges asked by the larger shareholders.
Yeah. So what I would say is, look, I think it's a different business model to begin with. So when you think about people looking at Pagaya, you don't really have clear, direct peers to actually think about the business model and the valuation. And that actually impacts a little bit how people think about it from a shareholder perspective. There is still a big valuation gap, let's be honest, relative to some of other perceived peers. And that's something that, we continue to work on sort of closing. What I would say on the confusion, I think what I would highlight is what I said, in the beginning of our discussion, which is, I think people received our sort of decision to cut the risk as part of the reduction more driven by tighter credit or other sort of disruption in the marketplace. Whereas the reality is it was a much earlier indicator across multiple partners, as I said before, in terms of how they're thinking about their growth. So sort of call it a second derivative in terms of how they think about 2026 rather than a direct cut. And I think so that's something to keep in mind. And then people again say, well, I'm still confused. Others are saying they're still growing. Yes, they are still growing. Our partners are still growing, maybe to a lesser extent than it did in 2025. But when you see it across multiple partners, and now, more importantly, you have the ability to cut the riskier part of the production in light of the uncertainty and still deliver the type of profitability, bottom line profitability that we can. That's a unique position to be. I encourage people to think about where we're sitting in December again. And if I know as a leadership team that I can deliver $100 million-$150 million of profitability despite the cuts, given the uncertainty and given some of the signaling, it's something that, we feel very good about acting, and that's what we did. And again, if we were wrong, we would be able to react quickly and, just having left some money on the table for a few quarters. I think that there was a little bit of confusion, but hopefully that gives a little bit more clarity. You have to put in perspective the signals, the persistency, the persistency and the consistency of those. Together, though, with the underlying operating parts of our business, which is quite unique relative to some of the other players, and how we can react to it.
Perfect. Well, I think we're up on time, and I think that's a perfect note to end on. EP, just wanted to say thanks again for agreeing to join us for this fireside chat. Some great insights and key takeaways from my perspective, and I hope the investors who were able to join was able to gain a lot from this. Thanks to all of the investors who joined and participated with questions. And EP, thanks again. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.